Merci, merci beaucoup de pouvoir présenter quelques résultats de ma thèse de doctorat ici à la Sorbonne. Merci à Jean-Baptiste Madieu pour l'invitation, mais je vais maintenant parler en anglais parce que je crois que c'est plus compréhensible par tous. Okay. Poison, seductive, pernicious, a pleasure to this degenerated century. These expressions, taken from various votums on English works written by Roman Catholic censors, do not refer to the content of some dingy love stories, to some cheap novelettes, or to some shady Gothic novels. The Roman Catholic monks and priests were talking about something that we have been talking about for 3 days now, about how a book is written, about its style, and about how it affected its readers. And not only its readers. Today I'm going to talk to you about my research on 19th century English literature on the index and about one issue that has attracted my interest in all the cases I've dealt with. That is how style and the use of particular rhetorical devices affected the Roman censors and with that finally the verdicts on the works they examined. There can be no doubt that there had been a wide gulf between England and the center of the Catholic Church in Rome ever since the Anglican Reformation. I am not, however, going to talk about all the political and theological differences today. Yet, the English literary tradition too, especially after the Enlightenment, developed in such a manner that did not please the Catholic Church and the Roman book censorship authorities at all. I would like to distinguish two tracks. Content-wise, on the one hand, several authors dared to say the unsayable. They questioned the existence of God, ridiculed the Catholic Church, its pastors, its dogmas, its institutions, etc., had a, let me call it, relaxed view of human and social intercourse. In short, they did not bother about the Roman view of fides et mores, of faith and mores. Style-wise, on the other hand, a number of techniques and traditions came to be en vogue, which could not please an institution that claimed to be the one and only keeper of the one and only crystal clear truth. Let's just think about rhetorical devices as irony, sarcasm, satire, puns, double entendre, or ambiguities. So basically many of the things that we today would define as typical British humor. Moreover, think of the myriad of essays that were issued, following, of course, such French examples as Michel de Montaigne's Essai, of histories and encyclopedias which sought to inform, to instruct, to reflect, but also to criticize established truth, many of which were, figuratively speaking, dressed in a beautiful robe. They were written in an enjoyable and popular language that made it accessible to a broad public. Prospero Piatti, the monk who examined David Hume's famous History of England in 1827, stated in his votum, I quote, "It is not difficult to see that this history, written by a godless man, as we all know, must be forbidden, both for the iniquitable doctrines which are therein contained and for the seducing manner in which it is written," unquote. Gustavo Costa put it nicely in an article on the prohibition of Jonathan Swift's satire A Tale of a Tub in 1734. He argued that in the crusade against the Catholic Church, the devil, who had first sent reformatory emissaries as Luther, Zwingli, or Calvin, has now changed his tactics by sending authors whose well and easily written and also humorous works are better to read than ponderous erudite literature, and therefore so much more dangerous. That style was a sort of, let me call it, booster for the condemnation of books, if not the primary reason that a book was ended up on the index, does not, of course, only apply to English literature. We heard about it yesterday from Laurence Massé's presentation, and I think everyone who deals with Roman book censorship will have come across this phenomenon. Those English books that ended up on the index in the 19th century, a rather small number in comparison to the plethora of French books censored, have one common denominator. They are in one way or the other critical of the Catholic Church or of Italy. This is, so to speak, the core, the heart of their depravity. They are already condemnable by themselves, but additionally, they come in a pleasant and with that seductive guise. In 1852, the Congregation of the Index examined Percy Bysshe Shelley's, a volume of Percy Bysshe Shelley's poetical works. Therein contained was his Queen Mab and the tragedy The Cenci. The censor's opinion was quite clear. He wrote, "These are verses by a Protestant, or rather an atheist, and only this is sufficient for your most reverend eminences to apply the general rule of the Index concerning books by heretics." And he quotes a passage from Queen Mab, which clearly reveals that the author is everything but a God-fearing creature. It says, I quote, "There is no God. Nature confirms the faith this death ground sealed. Let heaven and earth, let man's revolving race, his ceaseless generations tell the tale. Let every part depending on the chain that links it to the whole point to the hand that grasps its term. Let every seed that falls in silent eloquence unfold its store of argument, infinity within, infinity without, belie creation. The exterminable spirit it contains is nature's only God, but human pride is skillful to invent most serious names to hide its ignorance." So this is blatant atheism, of course, and must, in the opinion of the censor, be forbidden according to the second rule of the Index, which refers to Libri a Catholicorum qui ex professo de religione tractant. Not only, however, should it be forbidden, the censor remarked as well, these poems merit to be burned. However, he notices, I quote, "In my opinion, it is not opportune to put this title on the Index, as such books are already prohibited by law. Otherwise, we would have to fill the Index with the names of thousands of Protestants and examine endless products of un-Catholic pens, which from the birth on are hit by the anathema of the Church," unquote. So this is a very common argumentation and partially also explains why so little English, that means un-Catholic books, were put on the Index. But some of the cardinals, who always had the final say, did not agree. In the Relazione, which summed up the discussion of the Congregatio Generalis, the cardinals' final and decisive meeting, it says, I quote, "However, as we are of the opinion that today it is en vogue to produce books which are pernicious due to its elegant poetical style and the outer grace of its forms, three of the most eminent cardinals wanted to have it condemned by a public decree. Whereas the greater part of them, five cardinals, thought that it should not be mentioned at all." So we see some of the pauperates were well aware of the power and the danger of the beautiful poetical dress and wanted it on the Index as an explicit warning. They, so to speak, wanted to protect the faithful from this apple in the Garden of Eden. However, in the end, the majority worked by the book, that is, they solely applied the rules given to them by the Council of Trent. Let me come to another case, which is slightly more complex than the Shelley case. Lawrence Sterne, the great 18th century novelist, who was, by the way, a vicar of the Church of England, traveled to France and Italy in the mid-18th century and digested his experience in a somewhat unusual travel novel, A Sentimental Journey Through France and Italy, which was left unfinished as the author died shortly after he had published the first part of it in 1768. It was only late in his life that Sterne started his literary career, and as he did so, he inserted himself in the English and European tradition of learned wit. He had numerous European literary examples, such as the French satirist François Rabelais, apart from that Michel de Montaigne, Miguel de Cervantes, some of his English colleagues, such as Swift and Alexander Pope. By the way, all of his models, his examples, except for Cervantes, ended up on the Index or were examined by one of the congregations. Already in his first major work, The Life and Opinions of Tristram Shandy, he derided, ridiculed, parodied, and satirized mankind in general, society, the church, social and personal relationship, and, let me call it, the minor and unmentionable businesses of human life. The book was full of dirty jokes, puns and ambiguities. I will not dwell on that much longer, but I just want to mention one thing, how this satirical, bawdy, and frank style was received by his English contemporaries. Although he himself professed, I quote, "I care not a curse for the critics," his review's assessment of his works was crucial for himself and for the development of his writing. There were some critics that loved the book. He was, for example, called a writer infinitely more ingenious and entertaining than any other of the present race of novelists. But the majority did not like it at all, especially as they connected it to his priesthood and to his private life, because Sterne was known to have numerous extramarital affairs. There was a myriad of reviews in English magazines. After the first volumes had been published, Tristram Shandy was called an obscene novel, a shame to the public taste, exclamation mark, an outrage against Christianity and a mockery on religion. And indeed, the continuation of his novel sold badly, and the reviews became more hostile than ever. This made Sterne reflect. As Virginia Woolf put it, I quote, "Sterne, however little he let it show on the surface, laid the criticism to heart," unquote. He saw a need to satisfy the public, a need for bienséance, and indeed, and this is shown from his correspondence, he decided to turn away from his salty and caricaturing irony and his bawdy jokes. In his following work, A Sentimental Journey, he intended to increasingly turn towards something that he defined as the depth of my sensibility, to explore man's sentiments and feelings without, which does not mean that he entirely lost his humor. It is rather that he did not point a finger at human deficiencies, but rather laughed with them about the imperfection of human life and the mischief that man got into. He himself called the novel his work of redemption, which suggests how powerful the media's opinion was in Sterne's time already, because after all, what had happened was nothing less than that what we today would call a shitstorm. The reviews had the power to influence both the audience, the declining number of books sold as a clear proof of it, and the author, as Sterne's chain of mind and his culpability clearly show. Just as the Roman censors, they had a massive influence on the book market, and Sterne's case is not the only one that prompts that, but in a very different way. Whereas a verdict issued by the Congregation of the Index or the Holy Office was prescriptive, a clear no to all Catholics, and, well, no contemporary ever know why, a review, however powerful and devastating it may have been, was commendatory and left the final decision to the reader. So Tristram Shandy was never examined or forbidden by the Roman censorship authorities, but A Sentimental Journey was denounced to the Congregation of the Index in 1819. The votum, written by a certain Camaldolese monk called Albertino Belenghi, shows that Sterne did not manage to write a truly decent book that came up to the Catholic Church's expectations. However, the first thing that stands out is the fact that Sterne's name is missing in all of the documents. Only the translator's name, a certain Didimo Chierico, is mentioned. But who is this Chierico? It is a pseudonym of the Italian novelist Ugo Foscolo, the author of the famous Ultime Lettere di Jacopo Ortis. He worked as a translator as well, and as we will see, he played a major part in contributing to Sterne's condemnation by the Congregation of the Index. Let's have a look at the census votum. Incipiently, Belenghi calls this journey a, I quote, "booklet whose only purposes are to promote obscenity, indecency, and seduction by continuously abusing extracts from the Holy Bible, which the author twists in an improper and nefarious sense, and in which there are various scandalous and erroneous propositions." He then points to various chapters that give proof of these charges and gives a few quotations, just a few, obviously, because he does not want to repeat all the author's monstrosities, or he considers them unsuitable for the cardinal's ears. If we, however, have a look at the incriminated passages, we notice that in several cases, it was Foscolo's style and the choice of his words that again boosted Stern's passages that per se already contained something that was worth criticizing. I would like to mention two passages. Belenghi, among others, points to the chapter The Remise Door, in which Yorick, Stern's protagonist, meets a beautiful woman and dares to take her hand. The atmosphere is erotically charged, of course, nothing that a Roman censor might like. Stern describes it as a, I quote, pleasurable ductility which spread a calmness over all my spirits. Foscolo translates this phrase as, I quote, tale voluttuosa arrendevolezza che confortò di dolcissima calma tutti i miei spiriti. Not only does he add an extra adjective, dolcissima, and to that a superlative, but the adjective he uses to translate pleasurable, voluttuosa, deriving, of course, from the Latin voluptas, one of the seven deadly sins, bears a much stronger erotic connotation than the English original. Additionally, Foscolo, who enhances an ample paratext, a variety of footnotes to the entire translation, adds an explanatory footnote after this passage. In that, he wonders whether the reader might imagine Yorick seeing this woman as the ancient poets, so Pallas and Diana, without any veil, so naked. Or he might see them, like the antiquarian's view, I quote, those statues buried by the barbarians and the zeal of the Christians in the Tiber, only excavated in our times. He thus adds a slight obscenity, plus he criticizes the way that prudish Christianity treated antique relics. This is an obvious enhancement of Stern's original text, a text that in itself contains something highly licentious, of course, which, however, is fostered by the translator's semantic and paratextual enrichment. Let me give you a second example. In the chapter The Case of Conscience, Yorick stays in a hotel in Paris and has a lady visitor, which of course provokes quite a scandal to the Holton manager, who after that asks him to leave. It's no date, but it's just a fille de chambre who's delivering in a commission, but she stays 2 hours, and the young woman that spent so much time in a man's room is nothing but a scandal to Stern's contemporary reader, and of course to the Roman censor, Albertino Belenghi. And again, Foscolo has something to add to this. Stern, has the hotel manager said, I quote, I should not have minded if you had had 20 girls, provided it had been in the morning. Must have been an incredible vision for Belenghi, I suppose. Whereupon Yorick says, 'Tis a core more than I ever reckoned upon. Foscolo translates in this latter sentence as, là è una ventina più del mio bisogno. The term bisogno, so need, or in this case rather sexual need, carries a much more greasier connotation than Stern's reckoning. But the conversation goes on. Yorick asks, and does the difference of the time of the day make a difference in the sin, which Foscolo puts it as, che la differenza dell'ora fa differente in Parigi anche il fallo. Here with the term fallo, the translator uses a double entendre with an overtly sexual implication, because il fallo in Italian does not only mean mistake, but also fallos. Surely this translation would have pleased that Stern of the Tristram Shandy face. But, and this we need to keep in mind, it was not the author who chose that particular wording that ended up before the censor's eyes. It was his translator, 4 decades after Stern had written this novel. So these two examples, and there are several more, show that, so to speak, in Nietzsche, the novel itself was already conceived as something highly condemnable by its author. The translator stressed, as it were, this condemnability by choosing a more ambiguous and explicit language and by adding ample explanations. And finally, the book was put on the index. Ladies and gentlemen, with that, let me conclude. Language and style obviously played a very important role in the condemnation of those books that ended up on the ominous Index Librorum Prohibitorum or that were acquitted after being examined by the Congregation of the Index or the Holy Office. Language and style were not the prime reason where your work was prohibited. As often as not, the pestilential content in the eyes of the censors corresponded with a particular style and rhetorical devices such as irony and double entendre, which were a bête noire in the eyes of the no-nonsensical censors. They made the, so to speak, badness of the content more obvious. Apart from that, one must not forget that books originally written in languages that were non-Catholic, such as English or German, were only ever read in translations, that is, in English or in French, as hardly anybody in the Curia spoke these Protestant languages. The power and the responsibility of the translator must not be underestimated. In many cases, he implemented his own personality and his own style, as well as the culture and also the literary tradition of his own country to this translation, as Foscolo did, whom it took many, many years to finish his Viaggio Sentimentale. So a comparison of the original and the translation might be enlightening to examine this. Finally, let me point to something that Maria Pia Di Donato has just talked about, and which in my opinion is also quite interesting in research on Roman book censorship. That is, an analysis of the language and style of the census votum, so to treat it as a sort of genre. Are there common tendencies, strategies, and attitudes? Did they differ, not only because of their respective personalities, but also maybe because of their belonging to a specific order, or because of the books they examined? Because, of course, the Roman world, as is the case with all senses, was not a monolithic block, but a world mixed up of different men from different backgrounds and from different cultural environments. They, however, pursued one goal. They wanted to protect the Holy Roman Catholic Church from the wickedness of the world. Thank you.